The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
And at the same time, you have Signature Bank. They're also a longtime partner of the Trump family, where Ivanka Trump once served on their board. They're saying it's also cutting ties with the family and closing their two accounts totaling more than $5 million. Also saying, quote, it's in the best interest of our nation and the American people. This, of course, follows the PGA announcing that it is pulling the championship from Trump's course in Bedminster. Also, Shopify ending its sales of the Trump Organization merchandise. So every day, guys, it seems like we have a new announcement of a company distancing themselves from the Trump Organization.
Well, you have the mainstream media gloating about Signature Bank cutting its ties with Donald Trump, even the kind of more supposedly neutral finance media kind of salivating at all of these different companies cutting their ties with Donald Trump. That was from 2 years ago. Now, Signature Bank itself has gone under. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, here on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Welcome back. We're very glad to have you join us. And as usual, there is a whole lot to get through. There's been a lot of events on the news over the weekend, and as usual, just a lot going on. Now, Signature Bank went under, and as you can see, they're a bit of a woke bank. They were kind of very proud to say, well, we're cutting off Donald Trump. He's got to close his account. We're not going to do business with them. That's what's in the best interests of our investors and of the American people. And now, well, now they're being bailed out by the American people. Now they're being bailed out by you, most probably, if you're living in the United States. It's a little more complicated than that. We're going to get into that in this show. They're kind of emptying a pot of money that could one day be needed by other banks. Are we at the start of a financial crisis? Other banks are going under. You got a good rundown from Sam yesterday on this story. If you're not familiar with it, with Silicon Valley Bank and what went on there, them going under, the events over the weekend, you can go and catch up on the Trumpet Daily Show from yesterday. But it's a story that keeps on going. I'd like to just update you on some of the latest bits and pieces from this story. Anything that involves our money and it potentially disappearing is obviously of great interest to all of us. We also, as usual, have a few unique aspects to this story that you're not going to get from other news sources. So, first of all, I'll start with this story from the Financial Times. Large U.S. banks inundated with new depositors as small lenders face turmoil. They write, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and other large financial institutions are trying to accommodate customers wanting to move deposits quickly, taking extra steps to speed up the normal sign-up or onboarding process, according to several people familiar with the matter. Wells Fargo banking analyst Mike Mayo, he said, Goliath is winning. And this article goes on. It's a strange situation. You know, normally you have a bank run and people are queuing up outside of the banks to get their money out. Now, they're queuing up outside of the big banks to try and open up an account. Because what they're doing is all of these banks that have gotten into trouble, so SVB, Signature Bank, these are kind of more focused, medium-sized, smallish-sized banks. And people are getting their banks out of those. If you've got your money in some kind of specialized bank, some kind of regional bank, they're getting it out of that and putting it in these giants. Just the way that this has all unfolded, it's given those big banks a lot of power. Now, some of those smaller banks that were in trouble yesterday, their share prices have bounced up, not back to where they were, but they've bounced back a little bit since then. So it looks like things are stabilizing there. But I think once again, we're getting a good hard look at cause and effect. You know, it's such a common thing for man, where we want to get around laws and ultimately all law really gets back to cause and effect. You do things and these are the results. And God has laws of morality that he gives us that it really are laws of cause and effect. There's laws of health. You do certain things, you're healthy. You do other things, you're sick. There's laws of finance. There's laws of economics. And in all of these areas, we ignore them and we think we know better and we think, but if we do this complicated thing and this and this and this, well, then we can get around the laws of cause and effect. And with enough science and with enough understanding and enough knowledge, we can figure out a way to break the law and stop the penalty from coming into effect. And we do that in the medical industry. We do that, you know, with morality. We do that in finance. And that's what I think, that's one of the big stories from what we're seeing here. You know, for the last 10 years, the Fed, the U.S. Treasury, they found a way around the laws of economics. They were kind of sort of creating money with quantitative easing and you know, the way that they did it, it's not straight up printing money. It actually even had some side effects that printing money wouldn't have. They kept interest rates low. So you've got tons of people borrowing money. You've got Americans or the national debts exploding. And central banks saying, well, it's going to be this way forever. Forever low interest rates, forever low inflation. I'm sure you all remember as inflation starts going up, people start saying, oh, it's transitory. It's transitory. It's transitory inflation. Don't need to worry about it. And, well, businesses responded to that. And banks like Silicon Valley Bank believed the Federal Reserve when they said it's just transitory. They believed them when they said, well, we're in an era of low interest rates and low inflation forever. We have solved these problems. We can encourage debt and get away with it and not cause a financial crash. And now we're starting to experience the consequences. And we're getting, I think, all of these little, I don't want to call the second largest banking crisis in American history little, but all of these signs that we're not getting, that you know, the laws are asserting themselves. We have not permanently escaped those penalties. At best, we've deferred them and put them all off into the future. So we saw this here in the UK last autumn when the Bank of England had to step in because we were at risk of a pension crisis. And it stems directly from all of this era of low interest and believing that low interest and low inflation will continue because pension funds made a lot of money they put a lot of their funds into investment vehicles that made money when inflation and interest was low. Because they thought, well, that's what we need to do for the future. We're always going to have low interest rates. And then inflation went up, it stayed up, it forced central banks to raise interest rates. And then all these pension funds sell these investment vehicles at the same time and crash the market. And we tried to get away with financial law breaking. It doesn't work. And it's the same here with SVB and these banks that believed that there was going to be low interest forever and you know, invested based on that that assumption, and now they're getting burned. And it looks like this is not going to kind of trigger the financial crash and financial Armageddon. But we have seen a very dramatic change now in how involved the U.S. is in its financial system. It's a huge event, and it didn't happen with any Congress never signed off on this. Senate never signed off on this. I think right or wrong, just the fact that Joe Biden and a bunch of advisors can get together and to make one of the biggest decisions in U.S. banking history just over the weekend. And that's it. There's no wider discussion. Shows how much power has kind of gone over to the deep state and how out of balance this is away from what the Constitution envisioned with the executive having to share power and all of this. Now there's just so many decisions that they can make like that. This is a great clip from CNN, actually. We're showing CNN in a positive, non-ironic, non-mocking manner. That's kind of unusual. But they capture the drama and the history of what's happening here.
What the authorities did over the weekend was absolutely profound. They guaranteed the deposits, all of them, at Silicon Valley Bank. And what that really means, and they won't say this, and I'll come back to that, what that really means is that they have guaranteed the entire deposit base of the U.S. financial system, the entire deposit base. Why? Because you can't guarantee all the deposits at Silicon Valley Bank, and then the next day say to depositors, say, at First Republic, sorry, yours aren't guaranteed. Of course they are. And so this is a breathtaking step, which effectively nationalizes or federalizes the deposit base of the U.S. financial system.
A historic step, and it is. Politico had a kind of gushing piece about what happened. Their title was How Biden Saved Silicon Valley Startups Inside the 72 Hours That Transformed U.S. Banking. So, I mean, they're very positive of this decision, but they're right that it transformed U.S. banking. And the Wall Street Journal had a bit more of a balance piece talking about this, where, you know, over time, there's been this development of how we do banking. And what they've come to is the U.S. government guarantees that the first $250,000 it is at the moment in a bank account, they'll guarantee that. If the bank goes bust, the U.S. government is going to give you that money back. And banks pay fees for this. But that way, the thinking is, if you're an ordinary saver and a bank goes bankrupt, you don't need to race to join the queues to get your money out of that bank. It's going to be safe, and so you knowing that, you can have more security in the financial system. But if you're a millionaire, if you're a wealthy, if you're an investor, if you're a business, you've got more than that in the bank. Well, you can kind of afford to take a hit. It's not the job of U.S. taxpayers, of all of these American taxpayers, to bail you out, and you'll get some money back in the kind of bankruptcy process. I think this story talks. I think the Wall Street Journal talked about it typically being about 10-15% that they would lose, but you know the ordinary taxpayer isn't on the hook to then guarantee the savings of these millionaires, and they know they go into this knowing the risks, and in theory they should have the ability, the time, the money to hire accountants, to do due diligence, to understand how risky or not risky that bank is and their investment in that bank is. But the Wall Street Journal says the White House says special assessments will be levied on banks to recoup these losses. This means bank customers with less than $250,000 in deposits will indirectly pay for this through higher bank fees. In other words, this is an income transfer from average Americans to deep pocket investors. So what Joe Biden did, or I mean, it's the Obama regime that we've talked about. It's the Obama third term. I doubt he's making these big, far-reaching decisions. But what they did was step in now and say, all of the deposits are guaranteed. Doesn't matter. You can have 2 million, 20 million. It's all guaranteed. If the bank goes under, the government's going to prop you up. And now they did say it just for this bank, but like they said on the video, well, you say it for one bank, you're kind of implying that is the case for all of them. So, you know, I think we're only just beginning to see the ramifications of this. It's a major change. It was made really quickly. Nobody's really looked into the implications of what this means, at least nobody publicly. You know, maybe the Obama administration has looked into that and are doing it very deliberately. But it's a huge decision, and one made with very little kind of public consultation at all about it. You know, in the UK here, you had a UK branch, Silicon Valley Bank UK. The British government provided HSBC or persuaded HSBC to buy it for £1, and that is a more typical way to handle these kind of crises. When you have a bank like that goes under, a big bank steps in, stabilizes it, and as a reward, they get to kind of keep all the assets. At the end, and there were reports that the Biden administration blocked that route for the United States. So, you know, did they want them to go down this big government route, where big government now plays a much bigger role in the finance system? You know, I don't know. It is just interesting the way that it played out. I think it's interesting the way that it's given a lot more power to big banks too. Now, I guess refusing to guarantee the loans would have given even more power to big banks. But certainly, the way this has all unfolded is now meaning that people are flocking to go to the big banks away from the smaller banks. And I think the way that, say, lockdown and the way that, you know, if you're a small shop, you have to close. If you're Walmart, you can stay open. It's really concerning the way that the U.S. government is actively pushing toward people towards big businesses. and actively harming small businesses. There's a very potential avenue for corruption. If you've got a country where you've just got a handful of big businesses, it's much easier for the government to get involved in that and use that to get involved in the lives of ordinary people. Whereas if you've got thousands of small businesses, that becomes much harder. So anyway, we're seeing economic reality kick in. I think another very important development on this story is how this is playing out in Europe, how this is affecting Europe. Because when American banks are in trouble, the rest of the world suffers. And there is a critical effect here to watch in Europe. So Credit Suisse Group's AG, their shares were down, they were at a record low. They were down 15%. And this has spread fears of systemic problems in Europe. And this particular Swiss bank, I think it's the second largest bank in Switzerland, they have other problems too. Their problems are not caused purely by, or at all really, by SVP. But it's just that people know that it's a problem bank. Banks start going bust in America. And people know that if big banks are toppling around the world, Credit Suisse is going down. And so very quickly, just within a matter of hours, a bank that few people it's not a household name, SVP. It's second largest bankruptcy in a bank in history, but still. They're not one of the big household names. They go under and suddenly Switzerland's second largest bank is fighting for its life. It spreads very fast. And this possible contagion to Europe is critical to watch. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about this, and Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has put a lot of focus on this forecast for Mr. Armstrong. So he wrote that in 1984 that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. So America's financial mismanagement, its corruption, things like you think about the FTX scandal. Sam did a great job yesterday just talking about the woke angle, and we kind of highlighted that in the open there, where it's all of these woke banks going bankrupt and regulators could have stepped in and solved this. But they didn't. Did they not step in because they were woke? And because, what was the name? Was it Sovereign or Signature Bank? Well, they're shutting down Donald Trump's accounts. They're one of the good guys. We shouldn't step in. Regulators shouldn't get involved there. And SVB, they're donating to climate change causes. And they don't have a risk manager, but they have a head of diversity in all of these issues. Were they allowed to keep going because of that? And so America's causing its own financial destruction. There's a lot of cause and effect. But then we need to watch the effect that this fall and this destruction has on Europe. It's something that Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has hit on quite a few of his TV programs. Here's a couple of clips from one of those programs from, I think it was 2015, that we've put together for you. This is clip two.
This debt is growing so fast that we're getting weaker by the seconds. And I mean, that's something we ought to be concerned about. So let me just take you to that scripture about the 10 kings, which ties us to Europe and their financial crisis. And it's all tied together. And what happens in America is going to intensely shake Europe in a negative way. Verse 12, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Here are the 10 horns, or the 10 kings. Now this is the last head of that Holy Roman Empire, and it's going to have 10 horns or 10 kings. It's not going to have 28, it's going to have 10. And that's what this financial crisis is going to trigger and promote in a powerful way.
That you're going to have a superpower with 10 kings rising up in Europe. And right now we have a kind of fracture, squabbling 28-nation European Union. What's going to cause that to happen? And Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Flurry both talked about how it's going to come from a financial crisis in America. And you look in Bible prophecy and it talks about these 10 kings. Revelation 17 talks about these 10 kings. Revelation 18 talks about the financial power they wield and that they're leading this global trade empire. So they come up, they their rise even is kind of triggered. Europe coalesces into these 10 kings in a catastrophe that stems out of America's financial system, and then they create their own financial system. Mr. Flory writes, what will cause these nations to unite so forcefully? It is very difficult to unite into one mind. That's an incredibly challenging undertaking. Mr. Armstrong had profound insight in specifically forecasting that the catalyst for this dramatic unification would be a massive financial crisis that starts in America and ripples out from there. Look at conditions in America and the world today, and it's not difficult to see how right he was. And he concluded, watch the economic situation in America closely and its effect on Europe, and see if this dramatic prophecy from Mr. Armstrong doesn't come to pass just as he said it will. So you can see how it's going to cause Europe to unite. You can see how it's going to turn them against the United States. They're looking at this saying, wow, you know, we had an economic collapse. We had a lot of real hardship because of your woke policies in your bank account, in your banking, and your financial regulators and your Federal Reserve printing all of this. You know, you caused us problems. Now, you know, the European Central Bank is doing a lot of the same things as the Federal Reserve, but they're all existing in this American-led financial system, and rightly or wrongly, they're going to blame America for these kind of crises. So you can see how it can feed right into this prophecy of these rise of these 10 kings and then how they turn against the United States. You can learn more about these kings in our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about some of the many other news events going on around the world.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
When he strode onto this stage 10 years ago, signaling he'd become China's new leader, he was a relative unknown. He was supposed to rule alongside these six other officials. But now it's clear that he's reshaped the Communist Party, the military, and the government so that he's at the top of it all. Some call him the chairman of everything. So how did he do it? How did he become so powerful? He started out with a bold vision, the China Dream. It unleashed big projects to build things like high-speed rail networks and new global trading routes that aimed to revitalize the whole country. And through viral incidents like this, a visit to a Beijing steamed bun shop, he cultivated a different image for himself, making sure everyone in China knew his story and saw him as the top leader. He reorganized the military, too. By ousting hundreds of generals and replacing them with his allies, he's firmly in control.
Shocking news from China yesterday. They held elections for their next president. The world held their breath, waiting to see who would win their vote. Just kidding. It wasn't at all controversial. It was Xi Jinping. Everyone knew it was Xi Jinping. Everyone knew it would be Xi Jinping so much that the BBC made that video in October. It was just a formality. But the nation's parliament approved his unprecedented third term on March 10th. You might be interested to know the voting score. It was a shocking 2,952 votes to zero. They didn't even have the kind of... Normally, China at least has two guys vote against it just to, I don't know, maintain some kind of illusion of democracy. So he's in his third term as president. He's also third term of the chairman of the Central Military Commission, general secretary of the Communist Party. That's what he got for a third term back in October, hence the BBC's video that we played at the introduction. So it's a big break, and I think that video did a great job of just showing how he's become so much of a strongman. I remember, you know, you can think back, we've had a few trumpet covers of the strongman world that we're heading into, and you see that in China, you see that in Iran, you see all of these strongmen around the world. And then the financial crises that we talked about in the first half, that's going to help bring Europe's strongman as well. So that's a story worth watching, and one that we've talked a lot about in the past. Another, I think we've just had some huge events coming out of the Middle East. It was great that we played the King of the South, Key of David, yesterday. I thought that was very appropriate in the second half of the show there, where there are seismic events going on across the Middle East. So on Friday, you had Iran and Saudi Arabia agreeing to restore diplomatic relations after 7 years of having it broken off. And you know, they've been kind of having this cold war, and it's not cold, in Yemen and a whole host of other places. They've been having this war going across the Middle East, and Iran kind of siding with Shiite Islam, or Shia Islam, and Saudi Arabia with Sunni. And then China comes along and brings these two together. And I think what it looks like is happening is Saudi Arabia is kind of concluding, well, what's the point in being America's ally? You know, America just goes and gives everything to Iran anyway. And so they're looking around for other patrons. They've been drawing closer to China and to Russia over the last few years. And you know, China kind of brokers some kind of a deal, and we don't know all the details of what's gone on behind the scenes, but you know, you have to wonder, is this just handed Iran control over the Middle East? I mean, it looks they're going to kind of reopen embassies and things, but then the Wall Street Journal had some anonymous sources saying Iran pledged to halt attacks against Saudi Arabia, including from Houthi rebels it backs in the Yemen civil war. And Is there some kind of deal here? I mean, we know Iran's not backing down. They've been pushy for years. They wouldn't have compromised here. So are we going to see this kind of see Saudi Arabia give up Yemen to Iran? Are we going to see Iran kind of step in that crucial sea gate? We'll have to wait and see, but I think it could give Iran a lot more power. And then you're getting Saudi Arabia breaking with America, looking for a new patron in China. And you know, as that King of the South booklet explains, this is something we've been forecasting for a long time. There's a chapter there on what we call the Psalm 83 Alliance, that this, you know, based on that prophecy, we've been saying, look, watch for the modern Arabs to form an alliance with Germany and with Europe. And for that to happen, well, that means Saudi Arabia and some of these countries moving out of the American camp. And so with seeing them do deals with China, well, that's what we're seeing happen. We're seeing them move out of that American camp, and okay, it's China for now, but ultimately they're going to start looking to Europe for their defense. Meanwhile, Iran is getting more aggressive. The Telegraph had an article last week. Iran is gearing up to attack Britain and the West. They've been listed as the second most potent threat to Britain, and Con Coughlin in this article. He says in security circles, it shows just how much progress the Ayatollahs have made in developing their military strength, while the rest of the world has been distracted by the tragic events unfolding in Ukraine. You know, they've been rising up, and like Mr. Flurry's talked about, you know, you can't work with. You know, we've got to do everything we can to fight Russia in Ukraine, but when it comes to Iran, the U.S. this current administration is supporting Russia, helping Russia help Iran. It's crazy that they would help Russia in that way. But when it comes to Iran, they're willing to do that. Another, I think, huge underreported story from the Middle East that we're seeing at the moment is the Biden administration's attack on Israel. This is, you know, I mentioned a few times, this is really the Obama administration's third term. This is really where you see that. There's a lot of ways you see that, but you see that so clearly in what is going on in the Middle East, with Israel in the Middle East there, where Mr. Obama treated Benjamin Netanyahu terribly and Israel terribly when he was president. And now it's his administration continuing the same policy. So you had the U.S. vote against Israel at the U.N. on February 20th. The U.N. Security Council approved a non-binding resolution condemning Israeli settlements. It was the first time that the U.S. had let an anti-Israeli resolution through since the closing days of Mr. Obama's presidency. And I remember, you know, that was a big deal back then, when America did that and did not veto this very biased piece of legislation or resolution. And it's a horrible attack. Melanie Phillips had a great piece on this, talking about what was happening here. And, well, you know, Israel has been under all kinds of terrorist attacks. There's been these rise in terrorist attacks. And then what happened was Israel legalized some settlements as a response to these attacks. And then the United Nations, with America's basic support now, steps in and does not condemn the Palestinians, but condemns Israel for responding. So Melanie Phillips writes, legitimizing the settlements delivers the message that the more the Palestinian Arabs murder Israelis in order to force the Jews from the entire land, the more Israel will embed itself in the entire land. But the Security Council statement that America supported wasn't deeply troubled by the Palestinian Arab terror attacks in Jerusalem over the previous 2 weeks, in which 10 Israelis were murdered. It wasn't deeply troubled by the Palestinians' unremitting incitement to murder Israeli Jews and steal their land in an Islamic holy war. But they're deeply troubled by Israel responding to that. If Israel takes even the mildest steps to defend themselves, well, this anti-Israel regime that we've got in America now is deeply, deeply troubled. And then in Israel at the moment, you've got this radical Supreme Court grabbing power, never really delegated to them, creatively interpreting the Constitution, striking down laws that these left-wing judges disagree with. And Mr. Netanyahu's now back in power and he's addressing this problem. And, you know, agree with it, disagree with it, fine, but it's an internal Israeli discussion. But the U.S. government is making unprecedented steps to get involved and put themselves into that discussion. So Melanie Phillips writes, the Biden administration crossed a new red line when it arrogantly presumed to tell Israel how to run its domestic affairs. Not only did it criticize Israel's contentious judicial reforms, but it issued a veiled but unmistakable threat. And they quoted she quotes a podcast from U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Thomas Nides. He said, we're telling the prime minister, as I tell my kids, pump the brakes, slow down, try to build a consensus, bring the parties together. And Melanie Phillips writes, these judicial reforms have absolutely nothing to do with America. They have no bearing on the Middle East conflict. They're in an internal Israeli issue. The reforms simply get up the Bidenites' collective nose because curbing judicial activism is to curb the power of the left to impose its agenda. And the left-wing Bidenites think Israel must behave as the Bidenites want it to behave. And she says, there is indeed a threat to democracy in Israel right now, but it's not coming from the government. It's coming from the thousands of opponents of the judicial reforms, who, oblivious to their own absurdity, are screaming that the newly elected Israeli government must be brought down in order to save democracy. It's coming from the calls for violence and even for Netanyahu's assassination. So they're not getting the blame. The Biden administration, the Obama administration, you know, they're not criticizing these people that are calling for Netanyahu's assassination. That's fine. But they're condemning Benjamin Netanyahu. It says, in both cases, the Bidenites blame the victim and excuse the aggressor. They issue no criticism of those threatening violence over the judicial reforms and trying to bring down the government. Now, and finally, in this kind of whirlwind tour of a lot of the important news around the world, I'd like to hit on a few social issues. We've been hearing a lot recently about how those on the right are just like Nazis because they want to ban books. You know, Ron DeSantis is trying to prevent six-year-olds from reading pornography at school. And so we're told, well, he is a Nazi. He's as bad as a Nazi burning books by Jewish authors for doing that. Because trying to restrict any kind of printed material from reaching any kind of audience is evil. That's the standard now. So, well, imagine my surprise then when I'm reading about a left-wing attack on a book launch. Now, the book is called Stolen Youth, How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. And actually, the leftists attacked that and tried to blot this book out. Strangely, the mainstream media is not calling them Nazis. They seem to agree with that kind of book banning, the typical hypocrisy we're used to seeing from the left. Here in the UK, there have been people waking up to the same kind of thing that Mr. DeSantis is trying to stop there with this extreme material going into schools. The Times has been covering this recently, and I thought they brought out quite a remarkable aspect of this story. So they're not a particularly right-wing news outlet either, but they wrote in their morning briefing on Saturday, "I wonder how many of us with children have a good idea of what they're being taught. In the area of sex education, the answer is almost certainly that we don't." And this was kind of their trailer or their introduction for an article talking about the way that even headmasters had no idea what is being taught at their own schools. And I won't get into all of the things that they are being taught because it's pretty explicit and disgusting. But it gives an example of where a parent can complain to a headmaster and the headmaster is like, no, that didn't happen, that we would never allow that in our schools. That didn't happen. And then, you know, he shows her pictures and the headmaster or the headmistress has to apologize. I'm like, well, okay, I guess it is happening. And I had no idea. And what's happened in the UK is schools have ended up outsourcing sexual education to kind of outside experts and come in and teach. But these experts, they don't need any kind of qualification. And what is happening is you're basically just getting a bunch... You're not basically, you're literally getting a bunch of perverts setting themselves up as so-called experts and then being given unfiltered access to the country's kids. That's what's happened in the UK. And, you know, the Times looked up what some of these quote, experts teach the kids. And the, you have organizations that will handle sexual education for 300 schools. And so they went and looked at it, and you know, one of the tamer ones runs a website on polyamory, having multiple relationships. I can't even talk about some of the other, they're just disgusting. You know, one of these other groups recommends that teachers watch pornography in class with their students so that they can, quote, help a young person build up their critical eye. But I thought just the fact that even headmasters didn't know what was going on here. It's a powerful warning of what Satan can bring into our families and works to bring into our families if we're not paying attention. You know, if we take our eye off the ball, and here these headmasters take their eyes off the ball, they start bringing into schools. Times had a good article. Melanie Phillips also zoomed in the end of last week on a pretty terrible article from the Times. I think this is from the Times article. Parenting tips gleaned from hunter-gatherer tribes in Africa may be the key to bringing up more contented children in Britain, researchers from Cambridge University have suggested. So, you know, we used to look, not perfectly, far from perfectly, but we used to look vaguely to the Bible and a Bible system to have our, on how to run our families, how to set up our families. Now we're sending out observers to go and learn from tribes in Africa. And they're coming back saying, well, actually, you know, we need to get rid of this idea of one mother and one father, and we need to have group parenting and all these crazy things. Melanie Phillips writes, one never ceases to marvel at the ingenuity with which those intent on destroying Western family norms find material to justify their positions. And she then goes through with just, as she does, a flood of facts proving, just even with reason and science, that nuclear family, you know, disproving this idea that nuclear families are a modern invention, disproving the idea that group parenting produces better results. But it is just astonishing to see how we'll go and try and learn. Who will learn? We'll learn from tribes in Botswana, but we won't listen to God. We won't listen to the Bible. We won't listen even to our own ancestors, to what we used to do in our countries. Now, of course, we have our own book, Child Rearing with Vision, that just has excellent practical tips on child rearing. And critically, the wonderful, the fantastic vision behind that. All of the material that we've mentioned here, you know, that New King of the South booklet, the Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy booklet that I mentioned at the start, you can get all of that at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can give us a call on that free phone number, 1-866-930-3024. And you can get in touch with us at td@kpcg.fm. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll take another short break, and we'll be right back with a bit of a Bible study to conclude.
The Trumpet Daily. A child is a miraculous blessing from God, an opportunity to build his family. In his word, God says to train them up in the way that they should go, so that when they are old, they will not depart from it. But how should you train up your child? Most parents do not know. Most parenting books offer only limited help because their authors do not understand the purpose and potential of your child's mind. As a result, millions of children grow up to be hopeless without any direction in life. Many come from broken homes. Many do not have a home. This is why so many young people become delinquent, rebellious, and unsuccessful as teenagers and adults. But you can rear successful, jubilant children and avoid the heartache of an unhappy and miserable home. God has outlined how to rear obedient children in His Word. Our free book, Child Rearing with Vision, will show you how to raise children that follow after God's abundant way of life. It will help you build a strong, united family. It will help you bring God's love into your child rearing. And it will guide you through the momentous journey of preparing your child to serve God the Father forever. Request your free copy of Child Rearing with Vision at our website, thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
I'll introduce this Bible study with just a quote from another news story. This was from The Telegraph over the last couple of days. The Welsh government says that statues of old white men such as Admiral Nelson should be removed or even destroyed because they may be offensive to Britain's increasingly multicultural population. So it says statues of old white men such as the Duke of Wellington and Admiral Lord Nelson could be hidden or destroyed to create the right historical narrative, according to Welsh government guidance. Historical statues that often glorify powerful, older, able-bodied white men may be offensive to a more diverse public audience. I am not going to start commenting on that because I will be on a tangent for a long time. But I've spoken about Nelson a few times in the Bible study portion when I've had this show. I feel a little bad for coming back to him because I feel like I have spoken about him quite a lot. But we went to visit HMS Victory with the students here at Edstone over the last few weeks, and it was just a fantastic trip. I was really impressed with the staff there, actually. I think there's some of the best museum staff of anywhere I've ever been. The woke movement has not gotten to the staff at HMS Victory. Maybe I shouldn't say that too loudly in case they realize and start trying to get to them. You know, there's one woman in they have people standing in all the different rooms. There was one woman in particular who we talked to for quite a long time, just because she had real pride in the history that she was talking about and enthusiasm. And it was interesting. It was captivating. You know, because she was excited about it, and it was fantastic. I thought it was really well done, their staff there. But and maybe it's because they're closely affiliated with the Navy, and HMS Victory is still the nation's flagship. I wonder if that's why they've kept some pride there. But then I had an opportunity the next day to give a lecture mostly to the students, and went through some of the lessons from Nelson with them. And that was a longer message, and even then I felt I could only scratch the surface. But I wanted to use part of today's Bible study to focus on one lesson that is especially pertinent for this time of year. We've got Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, coming up shortly, and this is a season that focuses us on, well, first on what God the Father and Jesus Christ went through for our sins, and then we get into the Days of Unleavened Bread, where we get the leaven out of our lives, and it shows us that we need to get sin and law-breaking out of our lives. And Joshua began to invade and conquer the promised land during the Days of Unleavened Bread. We have to wage war against sin and overcome it. You know, we have our booklet, How to Be an Overcomer, Win Your War Against Sin. A fantastically practical booklet, because we are in a very real war on sin. We have to fight. We have to struggle to overcome it. And so we can learn wonderful lessons from these warriors of history. And one thing that was really unique about Nelson and really applies to us is that he approached every fight saying, how can I make this victory as complete as possible, as total as possible? You know, when he went into kind of his planning, his approach was, well, I know I'm going to win. Not absolutely not in a complacent way, but he was rightly confident in the power on his side. Okay, that's fine. I can win this. What do I do to make sure that this is not just a slight victory, a victory on point? You know, what do I do to make sure that I totally annihilate the other side? And I think this is it's a fascinating way to think about warfare. Philippians 4 and verse 13 tells us that we know we can win. You know, if we do our part, God gives us the power so that we can have victory. There, you know, the Bible promises us there is no sin too big for God to overcome in our lives. You know, Philippians 4 and verse 13, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. And so, you know, Nelson knew, okay, if I go into this complacently, if I do this badly, sure, I can lose. That is a possibility. But if I do everything right, I will win. And, you know, it's God really that does the fighting, and he will win. We can lose if we don't do our part, but we will win. And that then changed his whole way of approaching fighting. And even Nelson, you know, he had a certain faith in God. One of his biographers, Andrew Lambert, wrote, this simple faith was the bedrock of his world, giving meaning to his actions and a conviction that if God was on his side, the enemy would not prevail. And this then had a direct effect on his tactics and on the way he fought. So another of his biographers, John Sugden, talked about how he brought a decision to naval combat to reach for the complete victory using more aggressive tactics. The old line-ahead formation, which had fleets of comparable power firing distant broadsides at each other, was powerful defensively. However, once respect for an enemy's ability declined, once men with Nelson's confidence in battle superiority rose to the fore, its rigidity could be discarded for more adventurous close-quarter tactics capable of delivering more impressive results. He and several others rethought the way the nation approached naval battle, because they wanted more decisive victories. And so they innovated new tactics, new ways of fighting, because they weren't just going for victory, they were going for annihilation. And knowing we can win changes the way that we fight. It changes the way we approach our battles. It changes the way that we attack them. And it led to an incredible boldness in Nelson. He took on problems that just seemed insolvable. One of the first times he rose to fame was in the Battle of Cape St. Vincent. And, you know, I'd read about this, but even the person we were talking to at the victory gave a powerful description of this as well, where he attacks one ship, the San Nicolas, and, you know, Sugden writes, the Commodore had no business leading the boarders, and his slight, sensitive figure suggested a man more fitted for poetry than hewing a path through burly soldiers and seamen. But he leads the boarding party. He goes and he attacks a ship much bigger than his, quickly takes it, but then has a problem. Because, you know, he's got his ship, the captain. He's then taken San Nicolas. Next to the San Nicolas is the San Joseph. And the San Joseph is a monster. One observer said that it looked large enough to hoist the British ship on board like an oared boat. You know, Nelson's own ship looked like a lifeboat for the much bigger San Joseph. The captain, it was a third-rate ship of 74 guns. The San Joseph was bigger than any vessel in the British fleet. 112 guns, had 866 men on her. And so, you know, this massive ship is looking down on the ship Nelson has just conquered. It's obviously an insurmountable obstacle. The only thing he can do clearly is to retreat back to his own ship and run away. But he doesn't. Instead, he's already on one Spanish ship. He charges to take the bigger Spanish ship, climbs up the side, boards her. You know, he takes on this monstrous obstacle with incredible boldness, and actually this obstacle turns out to be easy. they surrender this massive ship almost as soon as he climbs up there. Turns out the admiral on the ship was already dying. The crew was demoralized. And as soon as the first British soldiers show up, or sailors show up, they just give up. You know, this confidence in victory led to this incredible boldness and led for him to take on things that otherwise he would have regarded as impossible. You know, going back to this visit to the Victory, I think one of the most powerful rooms to me was the Admiral's dining room, to visit that room, because it was a big room, there was a table set up, and this is where he would talk with his captains. And he excelled in spreading his thirst for victory. He really stood out in trying to dine with as many of his officers as possible, even the most junior, lowest rank ones. If he was running any fleet for any amount of time, he wanted to make sure even they came to dinner. And he excelled at talking to them, spreading this thirst for victory, talking through a plan to be as total as possible, and then making sure every single one of his captains was signed up to it. I think if we look at 2 Kings 13 very quickly, there's an interesting Bible passage here that speaks to a thirst for total victory, a kind of Nelsonic approach in Bible in battle planning, where the aim isn't just how do I win this, but then how do I annihilate this? How do I totally defeat this? So, look in verse. This is Elisha talking to the king of Israel. Joash, I believe it is. And it says in verse 18, take the arrows. And he took them. And he said to the king, smite them upon the ground. And the king, he smote the arrows thrice and stayed. So he grabs this bunch of arrows. He's told, strike them on the ground. He does it three times and stops. And in verse 19, it says, the man of God was wroth with him. He was angry because he only did it three times. He said, you should have smitten them five or six times. Then you would have smitten Syria till you had consumed it. But whereas now you shall smite Syria but thrice. This approach to these arrows was mirrored in his approach to Syria. He should have just kept attacking Syria until it was annihilated. Instead, he attacked Syria three times and then stopped. Mr. Ron Fraser had an article about this years ago called Stretching Beyond Our Limits. And he said the problem here was that not only did Joash impose limitations on expressing his own zeal and vision in carrying out the direction of God's prophet, he actually limited God. In like fashion, we too can often limit God's Holy Spirit operating in us by not fully seizing the moment, not truly perceiving the full potential presented by any particular test, trial, tribulation, or course correction. We can miss the potential to fulfill God's will by using these opportunities for tools of our personal growth and knowledge. So Nelson had this ambition of, again, aiming for annihilation. I think I've just been thinking about this with myself. It's very easy. I think I've kind of taken the approach in the past of, okay, I need to tackle this problem, begin tackling it, but say stopping after three strikes. You're cutting it down to the point where it's maybe not a glaring problem anymore. Maybe at that point I kind of feel, well, I've got a bigger problem over here, or it's cut back. The situation is improved, but it's not totally conquered. And then we move on to something else. That's what Joash did. And Nelson really had this laser focus on not doing that. He didn't want to leave any kind of fleet remaining that could bother him later. If he was going up in a battle against a fleet, he wanted that fleet wiped out. And then so much at Victory was focused when we were there on the Battle of Trafalgar. And the story there. And it's a fantastic story. It's a story of heroes who imbued this vision of boldness and total victory. It's a story of Victory fighting the Red Retable and this incredibly intense duel. You've got the Little Africa, this smaller ship that Mr. Signal took a wrong turn in the night, comes flying across the whole battlefield, desperate to get involved before the battle's over the next day, makes this mad dash across the whole battlefield, basically, and makes a beeline for the largest ship on the face of the planet, or the largest warship, at least, the Santissima Trinidad, nearly twice its size. The Colossus captures three ships by itself. The Achilles. The Colossus fights three ships at one time, refuses to surrender. My favorite story is Commander James Spratt, who takes on a French ship solo. And by solo, I don't mean just with his ship. I mean he jumps off his ship, swims to the Agile, this French ship, and boards it by himself. and attacks its several strong crew. And it's his ship comes along later. They finish the fight. They win. Nelson can inspire this kind of focus on total victory in his men. We can learn from that. We can be inspired by this focus on total victory too. And our How to Be an Overcomer booklet will help you do that. That is all that we've got time for. You can get in touch with us, td@kpcg.fm. Give us a call, 1-866-930-3024.